All of us have healing work to do on race and culture topics. We have those questions that seem to be unaskable in today's climate. Now, we have a forum where we can ask experts, listen, and share. Welcome to A Safe Place to Talk About Race with your host, Sharon E. Davis. Get ready to engage and add your voice to racial healing in the next hour. Let's start right now. Here's Sharon E. Davis.
Welcome to our show once again. I'm delighted that you've taken time out of your busy day and schedule to find out more about members of our human family and ways that we can continue to dig our way out of this thing called racism and really put our energies into racial healing. You know, racism is not our fault. We were born into parts of this story, but we don't know the other parts. And people who have dedicated a lifetime of living that we need to know more about. Well, the answers really are within us, and that we as a group of people and part of the same species can do the necessary work to find out more and to be more and to have a better world where all of us can enjoy and leave a legacy for our children to enter into a world that's free of racism and racial conditioning. Well, our show today is titled, Think You Know a Lot About Arab Americans? Really? Well, Arab Americans know firsthand the opportunities, challenges, and work still needed to help all of us in the United States better live up to forming a more perfect union. What do most Americans really know about Arab culture and contributions? Is it a myth or fact that all U.S. school systems teach at least one Arabic word? Did the Arabs and Islam bring Europe out of the Dark Ages? And there's just so much more, especially about Metro Detroit, Michigan. And what is it about Metro Detroit, Michigan that cultivated and built the largest Arab American religious and cultural facility in North America? Well, I'm delighted that we have Mr. Charles Alawan Hajj, who is a founder of the largest Islamic mosque and cultural facility in the United States and has lived a rich history in Detroit. Mr. Alawan, among other things, was born in Detroit and considers himself a son of Detroit. Hi, Chuck. Welcome to our show today.
Sharon, I'm glad to be here. How are you doing?
Oh, doing fine. Thank you. Well, I'm really delighted that we can talk about Arab Americans and the influence of Islam and to share your wealth of information about this particular subject. I know that people can read up about you and that, and I wanted to also mention that not only did you attend Wayne State University, but you even studied at the American University of Beirut. Wow, Chuck, that's quite a history there.
Yeah, just briefly, I was born and raised in Detroit, went to Northwestern High School. Did not graduate from Northwestern. In 1947, my dad wanted to go home and visit a couple of sisters and took the entire family to Lebanon, Syria, and I attended the American University from senior year of high school, freshman year of college. So I had quite an experience.
Well, that sounds like that was another part of the rich experience and heritage that you had the opportunity to participate in and be that citizen in different parts of the world and bring that information back here. Well, you know, Chuck, when we talk about this subject of Arab Americans and Islam, a lot of people in this country still to this day, I believe, really don't know the difference, even in the meaning of the words Arab, Islam, Muslim, Hajj, and the like. Now, after your name, for example, is Charles Khalil Alawan Hajj. What does Hajj mean?
Well, Muslims around the world are required once in a lifetime to make a pilgrimage to Mecca to honor the prophet Abraham. And so when you make that pilgrimage and you go through the ritual and you meditate and you accept that you will lead the rest of your life conforming to God's wishes and wills, you gain a title. And that word is Hajj, which means pilgrim.
Ah, Hajj means pilgrim.
Yes, yes. And that's a title that we get after we make the pilgrimage. So usually if people within the Muslim community are speaking to someone, they will address them Hajj Chuck. In most cases, people call me Hajj Chuck. They don't use my Arabic name, Khalil.
Uh-huh.
And Arabic, of course, is an ethnicity, a nationality, whereas Islam is the religious belief. Contrary to most knowledge of people, there are more Muslims in Indonesia than there are in the entire Arab world.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. Over 400 million people, and I think the Arab world comprises some 375 million, somewhere in that area. So people need to know that places like Indonesia, China has almost 300 million Muslims. Russia has almost 225 million, I think it is. Every country in the world, just like Christianity, you will find Muslims. And in terms of numbers never really meant much to me, but it always proves a point. There are 1.6 million Muslims and 1.6 billion Muslims and 2 billion Christians in the world. So you're looking at a predominant segment of humankind that follow those two beliefs.
That is absolutely astounding, because I don't think that the average U.S. citizen, U.S. folks here, would have that perspective or even know that.
No, they get the impression that all Muslims are Arabs, and that all Arabs are Muslims, which is not true, because there are Christian Arabs. There are Arabs who follow the Judaic faith, and so you need to, I think it's the same thing in most every other country. United States, we can't all say that we are all Christian. We cannot say that we're all Caucasian. We have to deal with that. We've been trying to deal with that racial problem for quite a long time, and so you have to separate race from religion in order to know people, because it's not stereotypical in that. You cannot say all Arabs are Muslim or all Muslims are Arabs. Not true.
Well, you know, Chuck, along those lines, when we hear information coming out of the Middle East, it seems to be framed as Arab, you know, Arab.
Yeah, well,
is that our media?
Yeah, that's been going on for a long time. The association of Arab is oil. And the acquisition and the powers that hold oil rights, either by force or by legality, have over the years forged the idea that that is the stereotype. And it serves political purposes. The media has many reasons for not telling the truth, and you know, mythology is not just ancient Greek and Roman. It also fits the term of how our media sometimes formulates the truth. I was taught one time there's three kinds of truth. One is white, which is absolute truth. One is gray, which is partial truth, and black, which is an absolute lie. And that's propaganda, and that's the way truth comes out. And we deal with that every day. We don't even realize it. So, yes, anything that comes out of the Middle East has a flavor of oil rights, and it has a political, both a domestic and a foreign affairs portion. Let's face it. We have problems in the Middle East, and those problems in the Middle East are not necessarily nation-made as much as they are pressure group-made, and that keeps us sometimes from knowing the truth. Can't help it sometimes. That's the way it works.
Well, I guess that particular area of the world is not alone. It seems like so many areas of the world kind of take their turn at issues and opportunities related to whether it's minerals or people or the like. Well, you know, Chuck, one of the things I'd like for our listening audience to know is a little bit more about you, because in addition to you feeling like that you are a son of Detroit, and also, you've won so many awards related to what I call unity building. You know, numerous awards, including the Islamic Merit Award, Boy Scouts of America, the National Committee for Community and Justice, which I think used to be called the National Conference of Christians and Jews, mm-hmm. and the State of Michigan Minuteman Governor's Award, and the Martin Luther King Jr. Award for Keep the Dream Alive, and interfaith and race relations work. Chuck, what have you been doing? You've been doing a lot. Can you tell us a little more about why you do what you do?
Yeah, I think it was born out of the 2 years that I spent in the Middle East. I got to know more about my own ethnicity. I was 17 when I got there, and I learned more about my professed religious beliefs, and I got a chance to look at America from the outside.
Oh, wow.
I got a chance to see it as other people see it, and it brought some things out, and it made me, I think, a better person for it. When I got back in 1949, I spent some time thinking about a lot of things, and basically, I got married, went into the service, got out in 1955 and became an activist. I became an activist on behalf of the Palestinian people because I also was there when the conflict began, 1947. I'm not anti-Jewish, God forbid. I could not be against God's faith. I am anti-Israeli policies. Not mm-hmm. the Israeli people. I always define the difference between politics and humanity. And I still believe there's a great chance for Israelis and Arabs to come to peace terms. But I also began to look at the racial thing. I was born and raised near Grand River and West Grand Boulevard, went to Northwestern High School. I always liked it when my white friends would talk about humanity and the rights of blacks, and I said, well, you've never lived with them, so how would you know what their problem is? You can talk about it, you can read about it, but I lived it. I remember when Detroit was segregated. Mm-hmm. I could not play in a school just half a block from my house, Wingert High School, because that was black students, and they couldn't come up to my school, my school, to play. They couldn't play baseball on Northwestern Field. They couldn't go down to the Fox Theater. It wasn't possible. This is in the 30s and during the Second World War.
And this is downtown Detroit, by the way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we had movie theaters out of the four that were within a mile and a half of my house, all the way from West Grand Boulevard to Joy Road on Grand River. The only theater they could go to was the annex. I mean, we're talking about segregation. I have a page of a lease. My father bought a house in 1957 across the street from his grocery store, and right in a lease says must be sold to Caucasian.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to go down south. I mean, I know it. My best friend, you know, I'd want to paint myself as Lily White, excuse that pun, but my best friend in high school is now, he was a professor at Wayne State University, if as a professor of economics. He was my best friend in high school, and he's African-American. So mm-hmm. I've lived it, and I became an advocate for understanding, advocate mm-hmm. for getting to know one another, and I got involved with the National Conference of Christians and Jews. They didn't even have room there for Muslims yet, mm-hmm. and it has been a wonderful ride. Over the years, I've stayed pretty loyal to my beliefs. I'm not blind to the frailties of everybody. I don't blame a race for the problems of a few, and I don't blame a religion for the actions of a few.
That's a good place for us to break for a moment. We'll go to break, and we'll be right back with Charles Alawan Hajj.
Thank you.
Ask the experts. Call toll-free right now, 1-866-472-5787.
Hello?
And ask our all-star team to answer your questions. That's 1-866-472-5787.
Thank you for calling.
VoiceAmerica.com.
Many people are seeking to make a difference in the world, but few actually have the tools to do so. Every week, host Mary Beth Lodge and her guests will have you thinking forward and will give you the tips to keep your life, goals, priorities, and choices on track. The result is an easier, happier, and more inspired life. The name of the program is What Matters. Tune in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, 6 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. What really matters is the positive changes that you'll bring to your life and the world just by listening. What does the new health care law mean to you? Why is the country facing a deepening deficit? Can it be reversed? If education is important to fund, shouldn't we insist on seeing results? Do we have a workable energy policy? Who's calling the shots? Tune in to In the Public Interest with host Mike Hudson. We'll cover public policy, everything from taxes and spending to health care and other threatened entitlements. If it's in the public interest, it's in your interest to know. In the Public Interest can be heard live every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, 4 p.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. Come back to your senses. Imagine a radio show that will help you recover your common sense. Host Leah Brenda Smith is a health and wellness specialist who will explain techniques designed to help you recover from the stress of your life. It's all about how you respond to your thoughts. A little bit of self-awareness can go a long way in helping you to relax and enjoy your life. Tune in to Come Back to Your Senses Radio, live every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 1 p.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Stimulating talk
gets those synapses in your brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
You are tuned in to A Safe Place to Talk About Race with your host, Sharon E. Davis. We know you have something to say, so participate in today's discussion by calling 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. Or send us an email to Sharon at safeplaceonrace.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back. We're talking with Charles Alawan Hajj, and we're delighted that he has joined us. And we want to pick up where we left off. And Chuck, you were talking a little bit about you, the person, and many of the things that you have done and learned either here or in Syria, here meaning growing up in Detroit, Michigan. And can you tell us just maybe a little bit more before we go on about your background? And you left off talking about how that the Detroit area was, downtown Detroit was segregated. And you had friends from a variety of backgrounds, European American or white friends, and and black friends.
Yeah, my best friend in high school was a black fellow. And he and I were bosom buddies, ROTC together. We played in the neighborhood together. I had a lot of friends, and like I said, my neighborhood was segregated through the 30s and up through the Second World War. But when I went to school, the schools were not. I have to take that back. The grade school was segregated, but the intermediate high was not, which was ninth grade in those days. In high school was not, because they would gather in the students from the satellite grade schools around the area. But I had a pretty refreshing year of life in terms of knowing other people, getting to know various races and ethnicities and even religions when I was growing up. Detroit was rich, still is. I consider myself a Detroiter. I when I travel, I don't say I'm from Farmington Hill. No, I say I'm a Detroiter. I always have been. I still feel for it. I still read the paper. I still get angry. I'm angry at the way the students have been turned out of the schools. I think they've been betrayed. They can't read. They can't do this. They can't pass the SAT. This is not their fault. So I really feel that if there is something that's going to pull Detroit together, it's to pull together the educational system and get these kids on the right track. Now, I'll leave that and just tell you that I spent 40-some years in the construction industry. I was an engineering salesman. Later on, the last job was vice president of sales in a manufacturing firm in the Brighton area. And I've been married for 60 years to my bride, who was a Dearbornite, actually, went to Fortson High School, and we had three children and had two grandchildren, I can only tell you it's been a great trip together. We've been married, I'd like to think happily. there are some rough edges, but that's basically me. I still talk around the state. I still give lectures at the mosque. I'm actively engaged in those things. I like to fish. I like to hunt. I like to think, read. I've been a sailor. I've done a lot of things. But at the same time, I never let loose of the rope of understanding. I've always tried my best to understand the quote-unquote the other. And the other is always someone else besides me. It could mean any particular group or any religion at any given time. I've always tried to understand the other. Now, I wish Americans would try to understand my people as the other. It hasn't been, we haven't been important at all until we became significant, and of course, 9/11. And then Americans started to go into that stereotypical frame that they have, and as I mentioned to you before, we seem to like boogeymen. Americans just seem to like someone to hate, or someone to blame their problems on, or just someone to focus on. Seems to me that's been an entity throughout my life. But that's a little bit about me and my thinking.
Well, I tell you, Chuck, we've got a lot more to cover, but you know, one of the things that you said has resonated with me greatly, because see, I happen to know that you love America. You are an American citizen and you love America.
I'm a patriot. Pardon? I'm a patriot.
You're a patriot, okay.
Yeah, sure I am.
And in this regard, though, this idea that America loves to, you know, hate somebody, it seems like it falls in this theme since you have had the fortune to look at America outside of America, what I call get out of your American skin. And be at the University of Beirut or the American University of Beirut at a very young age. This whole thing about, America being number one means that somebody's got to lose. If we're number one, then somebody's got to lose. Well, and I'm hoping very much that we move away from that theme of winners and losers.
Yeah, in my lifetime, we had several incidences which brought it home to us. And one of them is when the Russians put Sputnik up in space before we had anything up there, that hurt a lot of Americans. We felt it because we are number one in our own minds. The other thing is when Gary Powers was shot down or however his plane, his quote-unquote his spy plane back in the 50s was recovered in Russia, we couldn't get over that. How could that happen? How are we spying on other countries? Yeah, we're spying on other countries. The Olympic Games, when the Russians were excelling, albeit sometimes with a medical change of gender, but we found out that we're not invincible. We found out it again in Korea. Of course, that was because of our own politicians. We had to bow out of that one. And in Vietnam, we took a hell of a beating because our politicians wouldn't commit. But by the same token, I mean, we had a hard, tough time there. So we are finding out as the world becomes industrialized and many countries are starting to advance, many of them to our credit, that we help them do this, that we're finding out that other people are in this world and they do have a lot of talent and that just maybe we're going to have to compete on a different level and just maybe, they're all God's creatures. And this is, you know, we still are probably we are the finest country in the world. We have developed a system here that hasn't been equaled in centuries, and if ever. And our problem is, do we realize our position? Do we realize that we have to persevere? Do we realize that we have to get better? I mean, these things, we just can't sit back and say we are the best and not work for it. So, yeah, I learned a lot. I've had a chance to see things the way they are. Never willing to relinquish the fact that, thank God I was born, and this is not idle words on my part, I was born in the finest country in the world and given the opportunity to excel. Just being here doesn't mean anything.
Well, you know, along those lines, speaking of learning, There might be a myth, or is this a fact, that all U.S. schools teach at least one Arabic word. At least one Arabic word. And I don't know if our country understands that. Can we talk a little bit about that one Arabic word or class that most Americans have heard but don't know?
There's this one word that I can always bring out. It's algebra.
That's right, yeah.
Algebra is an Arabic word, al-jabr, and there, algebra was formulated and invented and developed by an Arab, a Muslim. And so it's not the only word. Spanish, Spanish is, I can't tell you, maybe 20% Arabic. Malta has Arabic because the Arabs ruled in Spain and Malta for centuries. There are Arabic words. We use the Arabic numeral system. We use Latin figures for our alphabet, but our Arabic system of math, numbers, is something that has always been there. So I probably could go through, if I had a chance to think about it, words that we say that are Arabic. Someone every day kind of jogs my memory and I find another word that comes from the Arabic language. Now, why not? I mean, as I said, from the 7th century until the 14th, 15th century, the Arabs had developed a government that ranged all the way from Spain, North Africa, all the way across the Middle East, all the way into Iran. By the way, the Iranians are not Arabs.
Okay.
Yeah,
the Iranians are
not Arabs. Their ethnicity is a different group. They're more aligned with the Turks.
And, is that right?
Yeah. They're not Arabs ethnically, and the Arabs went all the way up into the Balkans. So, I mean, when I say Arabs, at this point, you have to think in terms of the Islamic world as well, because the driving force to drive them politically was Islam. And that's, I think, where we get it in our school books, the synonymous between Arab and Muslim, which isn't true. And, in fact, during the Arab caliphate the rule, the Jews held high positions in the finance system. Christians participated. I think Spain is considered one of the greatest examples of multi-religious cooperation during the Arab rule in Spain. So, I mean, there is a vast wealth of history. It's not too different from the fact that we don't teach much about the history of China, but when you think about the various dynasties and the 5,000 years of intellect in China, we teach very little about it. We have a lot of words in English, and we do have a lot of words in most every language that comes. I would also remind people that during the Crusades, the Crusaders were in Jerusalem in the Middle East, about 300 years. And, in 300 years, you just might take something of quality back with you from the Middle East, and they did. They took a lot of things. They took a lot of etiquette. They took a lot of music. They took math. They even took philosophy and medicine. People just are not taught these things. You don't get much credit if you're a Muslim or an Arab in the Western world, and I think it comes a great deal from a religious prejudice. I'm going to stop there. I could keep going on here.
Well, Chuck, we can pick up this theme. We're going to go to break, and we will be right back.
Talk, talk, talk. That's all we do is talk.
Yeah!
If you'd like to talk, call us toll-free right now at 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787.
That's it.
That's it.
VoiceAmerica.com.
These days, everyone is looking for information on staying young, healthy, and fit. The Voice America Health and Wellness Network is here to help you on your quest to better health and a better you. We talk about everything from diet, fitness, and aging to substance abuse, personal growth, mental health, and much more. Learn from our experts who cover health and wellness from traditional and holistic perspectives. Tune in to the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Healthy living starts here.
Each week, Jimmy Gould brings you the stories and the people that you want to hear about. Tune in to A Current Life to hear about the journey to success, how our guests became the people they are today, and the highs and lows they experienced along the way. Each hour will leave you inspired and entertained as Jimmy gets up close and personal with every week's guest and shares ideas you can identify with and apply to your own life. A Current Life with Jimmy Gould airs Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Listen for Trust Across America every week on the Voice America Variety Channel. Tune in as host Jordan Kimmel is joined by national experts in the fields of accounting, finance, organizational behavior, and sustainability, as well as companies that are applying strategies that are enabling them to be recognized as doing the right thing by the American Trust Awards. Your host Jordan Kimmel is himself a trusted professional with years of experience in applying strategies and consulting with today's leading firms. Trust Across America is heard Wednesdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, on Voice America Variety.
Streaming live, the leader in Internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com. You are tuned in to A Safe Place to Talk About Race with your host, Sharon E. Davis. We know you have something to say, so participate in today's discussion by calling 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. Or send us an email to Sharon at safeplaceonrace.com. Now, back to the program.
Oh, welcome back. We're talking with Mr. Charles Alawan Hajj, who's a founding member of the largest Arab American religious and cultural facility in North America. And before we went on break, we were just talking about some of the contributions of Arab and Arab American and Islamic contributions to us today in the United States. And Chuck, I think during break we talked about there's so many things that we don't know in growing up in this country, the United States, and that's not really the problem, but maybe the issue is why don't we know? And we were just talking about contributions such as some of the universities that were the source of how we train children and today in this country. Where were those universities, Chuck?
Well, they were in Spain during the medieval times of Europe when they were in the Dark Ages and the church was opposed to knowledge. The language of knowledge was Arabic.
And is that scholars, right?
Oh, yeah. Scholars from Europe and parts of the world would attend the university in Spain, in Baghdad, in Egypt, Al-Azhar. There were schools that that people, if they wanted to learn about science, medicine, math, philosophy, they came to those universities and they studied in Arabic. And in the meantime, many of them converted some of that knowledge, or most of that knowledge, into Latin and English and French and took it home. That's exactly how some of that knowledge came. Now, let me say this. The Western world took that knowledge in the last 500 years. I can tell you this, 500-600 years, we've excelled. We've taken it beyond the state of art at the time. But every history has a phase. And right now, it's the knowledge, the science, the math is in the Western world, as you well know, and English seems to be the language of commonality. So times change and people move on, and that's how that happened. They studied in Arabic universities.
Well, that's quite a history, and once again, for our listening audience out there, you know, we're born into these stories, parts of the story. So we have an opportunity to learn the rest of the story, especially about algebra. That's just such a universal word in our country among many, many, many more. Well, Chuck, maybe we can take a look at some of the questions and calls that have come in about our program today. And there are so many from different perspectives. Let me see. Where's a good place for us to start here? This is one of them that they enjoy this person who is an email from Linda in Southfield. I really enjoyed the canceled TLC show, All American Muslim. For me, living in the Detroit area, it gave a lot of insight to real Arab American families and their lives. Is Mr. Alawan familiar with the show? And what did the Arab American community really think about the show? And what were the issues surrounding how the Arab community felt they were being presented, how they felt they were being presented, represented?
Well, that's a big one. Certainly we're aware of it. And in fact, I know the mother and father well of that family. And I wish I could say know the children, but I've been around too long and wasn't that closely involved. We saw it. I think myself, as in America, I thought it was ultra-liberal in terms of Islam and ultra-liberal on how their outlook was on certain things, so I would have a disagreement. But to deny the fact that situation, that look, we're Americans. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm an American. I mean, hot dogs, football, baseball, apple pie, and all the problems that we have. I'm just as much American as anybody else. And I hate sometimes when people tell me, "Where did you come from?"
Mm-hmm.
Assuming that because I'm a Muslim, more than Arab American, that I must have come from overseas. But mm-hmm. Yeah, we knew the program well. In some cases, we're sorry to see it no longer on the air. But I would think the general consideration on the part of the family was that they were a little more liberal than Islam allows.
Okay, well, thank you so much for addressing it that way, Chuck. And we have someone who called in, an Ann from Houston, Texas. And her comments were a question. Arabs were in the forefront of science and medicine. They had an edge. Why did they lose momentum? What happened?
Not much different from the Roman Empire, Greeks. People become involved over, I think the Arab dynasties were about 800 years, and it fell apart, it got too large, lost its principles, went from an Islamic moral condition to an immoral condition. Mm. I feel like I'm talking about Rome itself. And Rome fell, and the Arab Empire fell, and I think over, my goodness, I don't know, 400 or 500 years, you had colonial powers. Britain, Italy, France, even the United States in a certain way became colonial or neo-colonialist of the Arab countries, and they've suffered for a long time. Much of their own problem, but now they're coming out with the Arab Spring. This is a rebirth, and I think the West is concerned about it. We always look at the bad side of things. I think it's good. I think people should be free, and they need to be free of these tyrant leaders. So that's what happened. The Arab world fell apart. It lost its credence and therefore lost its momentum.
Well, that seems how things do work. The rise, and then somehow things change, and then it disappears, and it rises again. Well, you know, Chuck, we have maybe three, if not four, questions that related to this topic. And I'm going to summarize these because they're kind of similar. One is from an Aziz in Kansas City, Missouri. And another is from another one from Linda in Southfield. And these questions center around Arab Americans, Muslim Americans, and Black Muslims and Muslims in America. And by and large, the questions are, is there any difference between Arab Muslim Americans and Black Muslims and African Americans and Arab American communities? How do they get along together?
Wow, big questions. Let me start out saying, you know, Arab American is ethnic. It's not religious. We have to separate that from Islam, which is a religion. Not all Arabs are Muslim, and not all Muslims are Arabs. And there are Christian Arabs. In fact, we have a large Chaldean community in Metro Detroit. They are from Iraq, but they are an ancient ethnic as well as religious group. And I think they would resent being called Arab Americans to a point, and not all the time, but they are a different ethnicity within the Arab community itself. Islam is a religion.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the African American condition, black Muslim, the Elijah Muhammad founded a religion which was not Islamic in its orthodoxy. It was part Christianity, part Islam, and I don't want to get in trouble here, but that's all right. I'll venture forth. And
okay.
His son Wallace D. Muhammad, or in Arabic, Warith ad-Din Muhammad, who today he founded after his father's death. He became an Orthodox Muslim, if he wasn't already. I believe he was already an Orthodox Muslim. And Minister Farrakhan maintained the black Muslim movement, and they are two entirely different movements, similar in many respects. But Islam preaches that Muhammad is the last prophet of mankind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there couldn't have been a prophet of Elijah Muhammad's knowledge. So there are some problems there. And so there is a difference within the African-American community, but the Wallace D. Muhammad leadership, God rest his soul, he passed away a few years ago, that is the Orthodox Islam. And I forgot the other part of your question. I'm trying to remember the fact that are there Arab and African American conditions? Yeah, sure.
Oh yeah, between a lot of
businessmen in Detroit are a gas station in particular are owned by Arab Americans and not necessarily Muslim Arab Americans. Okay. I was handling the public relations for the Metro Detroit Service Station Association, and that was after I retired for about 3-4 years. And we tell the gas station guys, look, don't talk Arabic or a foreign language in your gas station. That offends people. I wouldn't care if they were talking Chinese. If they're talking in front of me, I would like to hear English, so I would be assured of the fact that you're not saying something about me. And that's a condition of all human beings. And so we used to have problems. And, of course, you know that there are shootings and robberies and all kind of problems. And there have been more than they are today existent between the African-American community and the Arab-American dealers. But I think they're learning. I think everybody gets to learn how to get along with each other. These gas station guys put a lot of time in there, and they have a lot of money invested. Listen, when all the gas station companies moved out of the city of Detroit, I can remember a time there were hundreds of closed stations. Air America said, look, we'll open them. We can do this. We can do this, and, you know, we can open the business and do business and hire people, and they do, although most of the stations today are self-serve, but they were the only businessmen that would go in there and take them over.
Well, that is part of history that needs to be brought out. So there was a void. I'm going to say it this way, Chuck. There was a void in the city of Detroit that businesses were fleeing left and right,
sure.
And that void was filled by Arab American businessmen.
The same thing happened with supermarkets and grocery stores.
Right.
And the Chaldean people came in and opened up some of those large supermarkets and had businesses there. And there was always friction between the communities, the African-American community and these business people. There's always a resentment between, I don't like to use the word of have-not and have-not. But look, Arab Americans are entrepreneurs. They're entrepreneurs from their toes to the tip of their heads. Sure, some of them would work in the factory, but a heck of a lot more have opened businesses. That's their nature. It comes from their trading experience throughout history. But there was always a resentment about the fact that, you know, here's this bunch of foreigners making the American dream come true when we can't.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another issue that I used to meet regularly on is at one time the banks wouldn't lend a nickel to an African American. And we addressed that subject. I on a committee at Wayne University, going back 20 years, in which we addressed that subject, and we changed things around by committee, and we got not only the banks to reconsider, but we helped found a group that started to put money, and it was probably through the Episcopal Church there, Bishop McGeehee, that we were able to form an organization that started to loan money. So yeah, African Americans were hard pressed. I mean, I don't blame them. They couldn't get a loan if they wanted to. Well, it's coming around. It takes time. America, I told you about boogeyman, you know. America had that boogeyman for a long time, race.
Well, you know, it hasn't gone away, but I'm hoping with information that you're sharing and this show that it will definitely help. Well, we have a caller online, and our caller is J.R. from Battle Creek. Hi, J.R. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks a lot. I have a question. Well, first a comment. I've been to the mosque in Dearborn, and the thing that struck me the most, I'm a Christian, is how... And please don't take this the wrong way, how it was very beautiful, but it was very familiar in a lot of ways and quite ordinary as it relates to going to other places of worship. So that sort of surprised me based on all of the things that you see on TV and sort of the stereotypes that are out there. But my question is, in Battle Creek, which is a little town here in Michigan, I do work that's related to race, and I want to be a better ally to the Arab community, and I was wondering if you could just speak to a couple of different ways that I can do that. I don't know. I don't think there's a big Arab community here, but I'm always trying to get people to understand and educate them.
It's ironic. I've spoken 2 years in a row, this year and last year, in Battle Creek on Islam. In fact, the last one I participated in a discussion between a rabbi, a Christian minister, and myself, and I'm sorry that you didn't get a heads up on advertising there that was for that, number one. Number two, I'm not sure what your description of the mosque was. A mosque is a jama. It's the Arabic word is jama. A mosque is a anglicized, I don't know where it came from. It means a place of congregation. If there's anything holy about a mosque, it's that it's dedicated to the remembrance, the prayers, the gaining of knowledge of the Creator. And I'm not sure what you meant by your description, except that it's both a social gathering place as well as a religious. If you went into the sanctuary is where we cleanse ourselves before going in and we pray and we meditate, and the surrounding element is for our congregational gathering. So it has a little different connotation. I think much like a Jewish synagogue differs. Christian churches today have come a long way since I was a kid. I don't want to spend my subject here, but Christian churches do a lot more socializing, a lot more music, a lot of different things. Churches are not just as a building that has to stand there for Sunday, you know. It's a seven-day thing. As far as knowledge, look, if you want to interact, you have to seek out people who are there. There's a group in Battle Creek called Building Bridges, and if you could get hold of them, I'm sure they would love to have you participate because that's what they do. As far as Arab American, I think you directed it more toward Arab American than Muslim, and again, having understood that there's a difference. One is a religious entity, the other is a nationality. I have no idea how many Muslims are in Battle Creek that you could interact with. I'm sure there are Muslims there, and I'm not sure how many Arab Americans. The best way to do it, my friend, is to read and to gain knowledge and to get a better insight of yourself and then form your goals, because whatever you do will be for the benefit of the United States of America. The United States of America needs that kind of understanding. We don't have many people who are not Arab people, other ethnic groups, who want to and can study the difference and then serve their country. And I mean that seriously, serve our country. The State Department today would love to have people who speak Arabic fluently, love to have people who studied something about the Middle Eastern history, but unfortunately, we wasted our time, and now we find ourselves wanting. So I'm not sure how to go further with that, except to challenge you to start reading. You can get on the Internet, for God's sake. Get on search, and you'll get one subject after another that have to deal with Arabs and Arabs in history.
Well, I tell you, you know, I know that JR in particular has spent and willingly committed to unifying a people and does his homework. So I really appreciate that, JR, and your call and also your comments in this regard as well, Chuck. And, you know, we only have a few minutes left before the show closes. I can't believe this. And I wanted to get into a couple of other areas because questions have come from callers. So let's see if we can quickly go through maybe a couple of them before we have to go. This is from Ron in Dallas. When Americans visit traditional Arabian countries, it is required that the local customs be followed, like in some cases women cannot drive, teaching educational courses with male attendees, or be in public without a head covering. Some Arabian immigrants to the United States do not respect our customs, like women are free to marry whoever they choose and are not subject to mercy killing or disfigurement because they embrace this country's cultural norms and laws. Why is this?
Let me just start out saying that, first of all, stereotyping other countries, and they stereotype us also. Most Muslim countries would consider the lifestyle in America to be immoral in many respects, as we see them traditionally more conservative. The only country I can think of that I know of that women cannot drive, teach courses with male attendees or people would be Saudi Arabia.
Ah, okay.
The only country in the Muslim world that has that restriction. The Saudi Arabians follow a Wahhabi sect. They are the radical conservative group, and I say that. I don't want to get in a lot of trouble, but I think most Muslims realize that they're very conservative of. As far as some Arabian immigrants to the U.S. do not, absolutely. Like many Americans who go to foreign countries don't respect their traditions. And I think our troops are getting quite an education, and they're doing a fine job over there. I've heard from several of them that they have a different outlook. But, yeah, it's true. Those are customs. I'm glad you used the word some and customs. And use Arabian immigrants rather than Muslim, although there is both types that have that problem. Those are cultural problems. And this subject of mercy killing, most of the mercy killings that I have heard about don't come from the Arab world. They come from Pakistan, the Indo-Pakistani community, and not restricted to Muslim. Mm-hmm. So the Hindu and the Muslim in those countries have a great deal of cultural restraint when it comes to their women, and they do hold them very tightly. It's actually forbidden. There's no, the Quran says there is no compulsion in religion. You can't force anybody. You shouldn't force anybody. You should have the freedom of choice. So a lot of these things don't emanate from the religious background. They emanate from the cultural.
The cultural versus religious. Thank you so much, Chuck. Well, we might have time for one more question. This is from caller Ann in Mississippi. What is the approach taken to bring Jewish and Arabs together? How many people go to the Arab American Museum? And what has been the impact on their Arab people? Is there a lot of support for justice for Arab Americans in 2 minutes?
Well, first of all, the approach taken to bring Jewish and Arabs together is for Jews and Arabs to get together and talk. And I have for years. I have many, I hate to use that. I have many Jewish friends. One of my trusted allies over the years, God rest his soul, was a Jewish rabbi, and I trusted him explicitly. So it's getting to know one another. It's getting to understand the other person's problems and trying to come to some solution. The problem in the Middle East could be solved tomorrow if the Israeli people and the Arab people could sit down rather than the politicians. And that's from both sides. I don't care. You cannot escape the fact that you have hawks both in the Israeli government and in the Palestinian government. But you have a lot of goodwill there if they would just tap into it and stop killing one another. So it can be done because we are people of the book. I mean, whether you're Old Testament, New Testament, Quran, we all worship the same God, and we can come to some conclusions, and ethnicity can be overcome. As far as some of the parts of justice, I tell you, that question, why don't we try that on 202 sometime when we get back together, because it's a wide-ranging question, and I think that if I get started, I'm going to have a problem. but, yeah, there's a lot of room here, if I can leave just one thought. If you have goodwill in mind and not adversity, if you can come to the table with an open mind, you can conclude the best of things. But if you come with a closed mind and prejudice, nowhere, not going anywhere at all.
Well, I tell you, Chuck, this has been a delightful hour with you. And I want to thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and views and information, because we need it. The whole country needs it. We've been talking with Mr. Charles Alawan Hajj, who's one of the founders of the largest Arab American religious and cultural facilities in North America, and also is a deep, deep thinker and unity builder. Thank you, Charles Alawan Hajj.
My pleasure.
Thank you again for listening today. Please join host Sharon E. Davis for another edition of A Safe Place to Talk About Race next Monday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. We'll talk then.